This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mindy Kaling, co-created and is the main writer of a new Netflix series called Never Have I Ever that draws on her own experiences when she was in high school. It was described in Vanity Fair as breezy and delightful, practically built for quarantine marathon watching. Kaling first became known for her role in The Office as Kelly Kapoor. She was also a writer and producer of the series. She was an executive producer and star of the series The Mindy Project. She wrote last year's movie Late Night, in which she starred as the diversity hire in the writer's room of a late-night TV show. Let's start with a scene from Never Have I Ever. The main character, Devi, is the daughter of immigrants from India. The family lives in L.A., and Devi has just started her sophomore year at Sherman Oaks High School. She's one of the school's top students and is considered nerdy and unpopular and praised for a boyfriend. Her freshman year was a disaster. Her father died of a heart attack while attending a classical music concert she performed in. Soon after, her legs became suddenly and mysteriously paralyzed, and she had to use a wheelchair, which didn't help her status at school. The paralysis ended as swiftly and mysteriously as it began. Her father's death and her brief paralysis are subjects she doesn't talk about. In this scene from episode 4, Devi is introducing herself to a college counselor who's married to one of her mother's friends. The counselor specializes in helping students get into Ivy League schools, the kind of school Devi is striving for. The voiceover you'll briefly hear is by John McEnroe, who narrates Devi's story throughout the series. Devi is played by Maitreyi Ramakrishnan.
I just wanted to say how interested I would be in procuring your services. Your stats are amazing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I only got 28 kids into Ivy's last year, but I wanted 30. The other two went to MIT, but you can't win them all.
Well, I guess I can't relate because I do win them all. I'm in all AP classes and got a perfect score on my PSAT.
Great segue, Devi. Effortless.
All while volunteering at the Kidney Dialysis Center. When I'm not doing that, I read Vietnam Vets, their Bill O'Reilly books.
Okay, look, I can say this because I married an Indian woman and am a proud member of this vibrant community, but schools don't want another Indian tryhard who is president of the Padded Resume Club.
What? Renal failure is what keeps me up at night.
Colleges want kids with unusual stories. I had this kid. He got into a car crash. He was dead a full 30 seconds. He said God told him to go to Yale. It worked.
I outgrew a nut allergy, so that's something.
I actually know who you are.
You do?
You're the girl whose dad died in front of her at a concert and became paralyzed.
Devi couldn't believe that the major trauma of her life could be reduced to a single sentence, but there it was.
Yeah? What about it?
That story is freaking amazing. You have the golden ticket. If you're willing to talk about it, I bet I can get you into the school you want.
But Devi didn't want to use the story of her father's death as a way to make herself more interesting to a bunch of admission committees.
No, I'm not gonna do that.
Well, without it, I don't get your angle. And to be honest, I don't see how you would be different than any other Indian kid applying to college.
I'm not like any other Indian kid, and I'm not interesting just because my dad died.
Then what makes you interesting?
Oh, I don't know, Ron. Maybe it's my perfect grades or my killer test scores. Or maybe it's my bitchin' personality or my insane PowerPoint skills. I don't need some washed-up white dude who leases a Tesla telling me what makes me special.
Leasing is still a financial commitment, and my monthly payment is quite high.
Mindy Kaling, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your new series. Before we talk about the series, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. I mean, is that callous to say in this time? It's a lot of spending time with my daughter and failed recipe making in the kitchen. But given how terrible it is out there, I have to say I feel very lucky and happy to be well and at home.
How is it changing your life as a mother?
Well, it's really increasing my time as a mother. And so I am at home with her all the time with my two-year-old. And so she is over the moon. I think I was more of like a mysterious guest star in her life before this. And so now I'm really here being domestic. I think she likes it. And I like it too.
Why did you want to create a series where the main character is a sophomore in high school? Was that a turning point year for you?
So the story of why we did the show was a little bit unromantic in that I was approached by Netflix, by an executive named Brooke Kessler, who had read both of my books and loved the sections about when I was a teenager. And those are pretty short sections because, like a lot of comedy writers, I think of my adolescence and childhood as incredibly embarrassing and painful. But she liked those sections and she had seen that I had not dramatized them. And so she wanted to know if I would ever consider that, and she thought I'd be a good fit for Netflix because there had never been a show about an Indian American girl on TV. And at first, I thought it would honestly be too painful and embarrassing to relive those experiences. And it ended up being very cathartic because I hired a staff of many young Indian women, and we talked about our teenage years, which all happened at different times, obviously, because I'm older than most of the staff. They're all in their 20s because we wanted to get a young perspective. And it made me feel that all the stuff I was going through as a teenager, I was like not alone. 15 is a good year, I think, to start a show because it's when you think you can handle things like sex and relationships and going off to college, but you really can't. And having a character with a big ego who thinks she knows what her life has in store for her. We just felt like that was a good year. Also, we had enough of high school left that we could dramatize the show for years to come.
Oh, I see, because she's a sophomore now. There could be the second semester, and two semesters yes. of being a junior and then senior.
Yes, we have 30 years at least to do the show.
Right, she could go to college afterwards, yeah.
Exactly.
So in the
grad school, we see her give, yes, go ahead.
Right. In the series, her father has a heart attack while attending a concert she's performing in, and he dies, and that's incredibly traumatic, and then you're the main character has this mysterious leg paralysis that lasts for, I don't know, a few weeks or a few months. Where did that storyline come from? I nothing like that happened to you, did it?
No, it didn't happen to me. It happened to the brother of my co-creator, Lang Fisher. So when we were talking about the series, there's so many teenage series on Netflix and actually just out there about love and sex and all of that. And we were both really interested because we had parents that died unexpectedly and talking about grief and how grief manifests itself. And her brother, after her parents got divorced, had about 4 months when his legs were paralyzed. And then all of a sudden they started working again. And they went to every doctor and they went to every psychologist, and it was this mysterious thing. And then when that happened, in researching it, this is something that happens to people, particularly young people, sometimes after trauma. So that was hard to resist as something to talk about. And after she spoke to her brother and got permission, we felt we wanted to use it in the series because we thought it was a really fascinating physical manifestation of a teenager's grief.
So, you know, you mentioned that you and your co-creator both lost parents unexpectedly. Your mother died in around 2012, 2011, of pancreatic cancer. Like, what are some of the ways her death informed how you wrote the series?
And actually, a lot of unexpected ways. Lang and I and other writers who'd lost parents got to speak about that grief and unique circumstances that we thought were only us. Like, we found that between the two of us and another writer, there were these instances after our parents died that we would have dreams about them where they were alive. And in the dreams, we would ourselves say, wait, you're dead. How are you talking to me? And they said, no, I got better. And so when you talk to two other people in a comedy writer's room, and they've all had this eerie, similar experience post their parents' death, it is, first of all, strange because we're in a comedy writer's room and it's not funny at all. But also like, wow, okay, well, this might be happening to other people as well. So those are things that we put in the script as well, is dreaming about your parents. And also the peculiar way that your relationship with your parent exists even after they've died. And that's something I've talked to a lot of people, that they feel that way, spiritual or not spiritual, you know, atheist or not, a lot of people have that same experience. And so we wanted to put that in the show too.
So the main character has two best friends. One of them is Chinese American, one of them's African American. The main character is Indian American. And so they're known as the UN. And she assumes that means United Nations, you know. But she is also told it's for a much more negative reason, because they're all uneffable. So were you called anything like that when you were in high school?
You know, I'm sure I was. I never discovered it to my face. I'm absolutely sure there was tons of mean nicknames for me because I would hear mean nicknames about other nerdy girls who were not me. And, you know, there was a tall girl who I went to school with who was very beautiful, actually, but she was tall. And because all the boys were shorter than her and that made them insecure, they called her Bista. And she had no idea that was her nickname. And so when you hear about things like that, I mean, that's such a cruel nickname. We just thought these girls have to have this. And, you know, that's been a real reflection of me in high school and my friend Lang as well, where we were nerds and I'm Asian. So we were just gravitated. I don't know whether it was comfort. We gravitated towards other minority nerds. And it wasn't something I'd seen on TV before. I thought, well, you know, this was my real experience, so maybe we should show it.
Were you a serious student like the main character is?
It's funny you ask that because I was a serious student, but one thing we noticed when we see shows about nerds is that because they tend to be a lot of the side characters, they tend to be very demure and wallflowers. They don't want to speak up for themselves. And that's definitely a kind of nerd that was at my school. But there's also like the belligerent, confident nerd. They want big things for themselves. And even though they're not getting it, it doesn't mean that they don't think they deserve it. And Lang, who was also an overachieving nerd who then went to an Ivy League school, we both had this same experience. And we wanted to show an ambitious nerd socially, wanted to lose her virginity, wanted to be cool, go to concerts. And it, of course, never happened for either of us. But we thought that would be fun to show. You know, they're not all sad, quiet bookworms, although we were also those things. But we were like loud and rambunctious and opinionated.
Were you belligerent?
I think at times. I think that when you are interested in comedy at a young age and you don't know how to express it, I'm not sure belligerent is exactly the right word. I do think that I stood up for myself a lot in a way that probably put people off, certainly boys. Yeah.
Did you have a temper like your character does?
Definitely, and I still have a temper. Now. And it's interesting being Asian because I think that you don't associate Asian women with having tempers. And so, but so many of us do, right? So, but that's not the stereotype about us. So I was thrilled to do a show about a lot of short-fused Asian women and to show that side of us.
Did you have boyfriends in high school? Because your main character literally prays for a boyfriend.
Thank you for even posing the question. Of course the answer is no. It's ridiculous you even asked the question, but it was very polite of you, I'll say. No, of course not, Terry.
What kind of boyfriend did you dream of?
What kind of boyfriend did I dream of? You know, there's so many different kinds. One was a kind of, there's this term we use in our writer's room, I think we started at the office, called NBC Handsome, which is a kind of like Zach Braff, Adam Brody, a kind of like brown-haired, floppy-haired guy who is unsure of himself a little bit, but kind of confident and super quick and probably grew up in the tri-state area. So for me, that was who I thought was good-looking and attractive because I felt like they weren't like the cool blonde jock. This was like a sensitive guy who, you know, probably went to an East Coast liberal arts school and he could handle my Indianness. And that's kind of what I was drawn to. Maybe Jewish, you know, like that kind of thing. It was like, could handle the spicy Indian food without saying it was too hot or something.
You know, in this series, the main character meets a friend who is now at Princeton, which is one of the places that your character would like to end up in after high school. And she tells him if she's at Princeton away from home, she'd become an atheist and eat burgers and have a white boyfriend. But her friend, who actually is at Princeton, says, well, he thought maybe he'd feel that way too, but he has a Native American roommate, which has made him think a lot more about his own Indian heritage. Did you go through an experience like that yourself?
Yeah, almost exactly. My best friend from college, one of my small group of friends, is Native from Montana. And when we got to college, I was not part of like the Indian Alliance group. It didn't occur to me to be part of that, but she became very big in the Native Americans like student coalition. And they would have powwows and she lived in the Nat House, which is the Native American housing. And she was so proud to be Native, and she was so proud to share it with her friends. And I remember feeling really embarrassed about that because I didn't have that relationship with being Indian or Hindu. And we went to visit her in Montana and went to the reservation where she grew up. And she would very proudly say, you know, I grew up on the res. I can't wait for you to meet my friends that I grew up with. And I felt kind of ashamed. I thought, like, you know, why is she so proud of this? And Native Americans in this country have been through so much more than I think Indian Americans have. And she's so proud of it. Maybe that's the reason why, actually, that she was. Is there's like a defiance in it. But I did not have that same relationship with being Indian. And I remember being really ashamed. And that's a moment that we put into the Ganesh Puja episode, is her wondering why she has that relationship with her faith and with her culture.
So we were talking about how you didn't have a boyfriend in high school, and your character so far is kind of striking out. Did your parents have strict views about dating or sex when you were growing up? And how did their views compare to what you wanted and how you behaved?
Well, it's so funny you bring that up. I was talking about this the other day because it was a real paradox. We were told overtly that no one was allowed to date while they were in high school. Not that there was anybody knocking down my door or anything like that, but that was a real rule. Like, that was not allowed to have a boyfriend. At the same time, my mother really wanted me to dress very femininely, get my eyebrows done. She was totally fine with us going to Sephora to buy makeup, doing my hair. In fact, that was very important to her. So it was interesting. She wanted me to be kind of conventionally attractive and girly. I would even say more so than other moms, but then also shut the door on any kind of me having any romantic possibilities in high school, which I thought was interesting.
How do you reconcile those two ideas, making you more feminine, as attractive as possible, but not wanting you to have intimate relationships with boys?
I think she wanted me to be perfect. So she wanted me to be beautiful, and for people to want to be friends with me, and for people to think I was attractive, but then also pristine and not having a physical relationship with a boy, which, let me underline, would never have happened anyway. But so that everybody would want to be my friend and think I was attractive and pretty, but also was just this very focused, hardworking kid who just wanted to go to college, get into a great school. And I think that is something that would have made her really proud. And I was 50% of that. So, you know, I was the hardworking kid who got good grades. I wasn't the other thing, but, you know, I tried.
Would you have gone against your parents' wishes about sex had you had the opportunity, which you've made it clear you didn't have?
Oh, in a heartbeat. Okay. In a heartbeat. If my picture of Adam Brody from 1994 had wanted me to go to become his steady girlfriend, I would have died to have had this, like, stealthy, deceit-filled romantic relationship with him while also taking AP classes. I mean, that was my dream, to have it all. But, you know, that did not happen.
When I interviewed you in 2012, you mentioned, and I don't remember what the context is, you mentioned that you're interested in the prejudices that minorities have against other minorities, and you thought that was a really good comedy area. And you work that into your new series, in that there's an Indian woman who decided not to get the arranged marriage she was supposed to have. And she married a Muslim man, and then they divorced, and none of the women in this particular Indian community want to talk with her because she had married a Muslim man. Is that an example of what you were talking about in terms of prejudices some minorities have about other minorities? Of course, in India, Hindus are not a minority, but in America they are.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is definitely an example of that. I have seen firsthand the racism that Hindus feel towards Muslims because of, you know, it's weird to inherit a prejudice because of something that's based in India, you know, because I think it's about Kashmir issues and just the issues that take place in India, and then you're supposed to inherit them when you're here too. And so that character felt really true to my childhood and my life of a woman who had made a choice and then was shunned because of it.
And what do you find funny about those tensions?
I find it funny because to the average white American, we're probably the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is like, to me, it's really a narcissism of small differences. To the average American person, looking at someone who is a dark-skinned Indian Hindu person and a dark-skinned Indian Muslim person, I don't think anyone thinks there's a big difference between me and Aziz Ansari, but his family, you know, he's, I think, atheist, but his family is Muslim, and his dad grew up in the same town my dad grew up in South India, but my dad's Hindu, so there's this, you know, this giant chasm for people who are Indian about our different families, but to the outside person, they're like, yeah, they're both Indian, Aziz and Mindy. Are they related to each other? Probably. Like, so I think I find that comical.
So for you and Aziz Ansari, it's more of a bond than a difference.
Yes. Yeah, we've actually talked about it too. I think when he started on Parks and Rec and I had been on The Office, we got so many tweets where people said, oh, they should be together, they should date. And it was like, why? Because we're the only two Indian people on NBC. So I think it's funny when our communities try to find lots of different reasons why we're so, so different when, you know, a majority of probably this country thinks we're identical.
Yeah. Mindy Kaling, it's just been a pleasure to talk with you. I wish you good health during this really terrible period of the pandemic, and good health to your daughter and your father and all the people who you care about.
Thanks, Terry. Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure talking to you as usual.
Mindy Kaling's new series, Never Have I Ever, is now streaming on Netflix. The new Hulu series, Normal People, is adapted from the prize-winning best-selling novel by Sally Rooney. It's set in Ireland and tells the story of a will-they-or-won't-they romance between two people who first meet in high school. Our critic at large, John Powers, says the show is stronger on feeling than ideas.
This is a tough century for stories of passionate love. Not because people don't love each other passionately anymore, but because today's reigning cultural style is ironic rather than romantic. Artists would sooner seem heartless than embarrassingly sincere. One who's found a fertile middle ground between ardor and irony is 29-year-old Sally Rooney, the acclaimed Irish novelist whose books many of my younger women friends pass around like talismanic texts. Her second and most recent novel, Normal People, has just been adapted into a 12-part Hulu series, directed by Lenny Abrahamson and Hedy MacDonald. Awash in steamy romance, this tale of tumultuous young love is like a John Hughes movie, reworked by Jane Austen. The action begins in West Ireland's County Sligo with two alienated high school students. Daisy Edgar-Jones plays the brainy Marianne, who's off-puttingly and unhappily abnormal. Other students think she's plain and weird. In contrast, Connell, played by Paul Mescal, wears the outward garb of success. He's a good student, a star jock, and a popular dude. But his sensitive inner self feels straitjacketed. The two begin talking at Marianne's home, where his mother cleans house for her lawyer mom. With Marianne taking the lead, they soon start sleeping together, all the time, making love with a thrilling intimacy they find nowhere else in the world. Still, Connell insists on keeping their connection secret, lest he somehow be mortified in front of his friends. The power dynamic flips when they go to study at Dublin's elite Trinity College. Suddenly, the worldly Marianne is the cool one, while working-class Connell is the outsider. Predictably, they wind up back in bed together, launching an on-again, off-again relationship containing many annoying moments of miscommunication. I kept waiting, not a little impatiently, for them to finally stay together. After all, they share a chemistry that's always been obvious, as in this scene early on, during the run-up to their first kiss.
You know, you were saying the other day that you like me. by the photocopier, you said it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you mean like as a friend or what?
No. Not just as a friend.
Yeah, I thought that might be implied. I just wasn't sure. See, I'm just a little confused about what I feel. I think it'd be awkward in school if something happened with us.
No one would have to know.
Now, Rooney has a knack for revealing what's going through her characters' minds. She tells us the crucial things that they cannot or will not say out loud. The novel lets us see how Marianne and Connell's amorous vacillations arise from familiar modern travails, family dysfunction, class anxiety, shifting gender roles, and a distinctively contemporary uncertainty as to what, if anything, they should commit to. This novelistic virtue poses a problem on screen. Even as the series faithfully captures Rooney's finely etched scenes, episode 5 is extraordinarily good. Without her sharp-edged narration, it's hard to know why Marianne lets other boyfriends degrade her, or why Connell remains so secretive when he doesn't need to. Their tormented inability to express their inner selves makes the show itself a bit inexpressive. Hence its reliance on sex scenes. Normally, I dislike these things, not only because they look gross, but because all the huffing and puffing stops the story dead. This isn't true in Normal People, whose lovemaking features a bit of full frontal nudity by both of them, which you can take as a warning or an inducement. Neither exploitative nor gratuitous, these nicely turned scenes reveal Connell and Marianne's unique emotional intimacy, to them even more than to us. Yet once we grasp that their bond is special, we need less body heat and more inner light to understand exactly why they keep drifting together and apart, and why that might matter. That said, the series exudes an addictive romantic pull that will probably make it a hit. Certainly its young stars could hardly be better. Early on, Edgar Jones is pretty enough that it's hard for us to really believe she's supposed to be the plain girl. It's like putting glasses on a starlet so she can play a librarian. But her performance captures the wounded elusiveness of Marianne, who keeps finding ways to disguise her tremulous inner life. As Connell, Mescal may be even better, although it took me a while to believe he was as smart as the show claims he is. With a blushing Irish face that's often a roadmap of agonized confusion, he shines as a guy who would have it made, if only he could find a self he's comfortable living inside. Then again, such failure is almost the point in this ardent tale whose title could hardly be more ironic. Even as Marianne and Connell pine to be normal people, having a normal relationship, the series suggests that their inability to realize this fantasy may be the most normal thing about them.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large. He reviewed the new TV series Normal People, which is streaming on Hulu. The coronavirus isn't the end of the world, but your anxiety may make you feel like it is, and your home may be feeling like a bunker. This makes my guest's new book, Notes from an Apocalypse, strangely timely. It's about people who are preparing for a doomsday resulting from environmental catastrophe, nuclear war, or a pandemic. The book is also about the reality of anxiety, like the anxiety you may be experiencing now. Mark O'Connell is not preparing for the end of the world, but he is anxious about the future and what it holds for his two young children. And he's fascinated by people who've taken their doomsday and survival fantasies to extremes. As part of his research, he made a series of what he describes as perverse pilgrimages. He went to the prairies of South Dakota, where a former munitions facility is being converted into a, quote, survival shelter community. And to New Zealand, where some Silicon Valley billionaires are planning on waiting out the collapse of civilization in a stable, remote retreat. At a conference in LA, he met people who hope to colonize Mars and use it as a backup planet for a doomed Earth. In Chernobyl, he saw what it looks like in a place where all life was eradicated. Mark O'Connell is speaking to us from his home in Dublin, Ireland. Mark O'Connell, welcome to Fresh Air. How is the virus playing into your end-of-the-world anxieties?
I guess, like everyone else, I've been on a bit of a trajectory with this thing for the last couple of months, for the last few weeks. You know, with the first week here in Dublin, really right before the lockdown happened, I was going through a pretty intense period of anxiety and sort of uncertainty. It really did seem kind of a little bit apocalyptic, and that coincided with the sort of ramp up to my book coming out. So there was a lot of, I guess, dramatic irony surrounding my experience of it. You know, I'd written about all these kinds of scenarios. I'd written about people who were preparing for the end of the world in various ways. And, you know, I bought a lot of practical guides to surviving the end of the world, you know, doomsday prepper guides and so on when I was writing the book. And, you know, I read them at the time with, I guess, you know, in a spirit of scholarly interest. And there was a certain kind of arm's length irony there. And I found myself taking one or two down off the shelf in that first week and sort of flicking through the index with something other than scholarly interest, I think it's fair to say. But since then, you know, it's been interesting because so much of what I wrote about in the book has to do with not just kind of catastrophe scenarios or, you know, natural disasters or asteroids hitting or whatever. A lot of these people who I'm writing about, they're very focused on the prospect of civilizational collapse. So it's not necessarily the virus or the nuclear bomb that they're most focused on. It's civil unrest, and it's a lot of it is predicated on this notion that given a severe enough catastrophe, humanity is sort of bound to revert to savagery, and people will start looting and sort of, you know, stealing each other's stuff, and we'll sort of revert to an animalistic kind of original human nature. And I think, you know, with some sort of high profile but relatively minor examples, certainly where I am, what you're seeing is a strengthening of community, a strengthening of civilization itself.
Have you found that most of the people preparing for the end of the world are white and male?
Yeah, certainly, you know, the doomsday preppers who I look at in the first sort of section of the book tended to be overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly white and often conservative Christian, and the ideology that they bring to it is often one of, I would say, you know, quite right-wing, quite libertarian, a mistrust of the state and a kind of a, I guess, a fetishization of ideas of kind of rugged self-reliance and masculinity. You have to protect your family, you have to protect your home. Often that involves guns and so on, you know, particularly in an American context. So yeah, it is something that I think appeals more to a particular kind of masculinity, a particular kind of man, than it does to women, although there are, of course, female preppers.
So let's talk about one of the places you went to study the people who were really preparing for the collapse of civilization or the end of the world. You went to the Black Hills of South Dakota, where people plan to prepare for a nuclear war by living in a former Army munitions and maintenance facility that was built during World War II for the storage and testing of bombs. And you went there when tensions were really high between Trump and Kim Jong-un, and there really were fears about, you know, some kind of like nuclear weapon being used. So just describe this former storage and bomb testing site.
Yeah, it's a really extraordinary place, and part of the reason why I wanted to go there was that it just looked so otherworldly. It's a dairy farm, essentially, in the prairies of South Dakota, which, as you say, was used as a former munitions facility. So there are all these sort of overground bunkers, reinforced concrete and steel kind of mounds coming out of the ground, covered in grass. And it just looks like something out of an alien landscape. But all of these are being converted into So it's been bought by a kind of, I guess you would describe him as an apocalyptic real estate entrepreneur, a guy named Robert Ficino. And he bought the land and is selling off these bunkers for, I think it's $35,000 is the figure that he quoted me. And so the idea is that people buy these empty bunkers and convert them to their own sort of specifications. And this is a place for people to retreat to in the event of, I mean, yeah, certainly nuclear exchange is one of the big ones, but, you know, also things like viral pandemics and any kind of situation that threatens civilizational collapse or, you know, civil unrest. And the idea is that there would be an army, like a private army that would patrol the perimeter of this place to stop the to stop the rest of us getting in, I suppose.
Was there just a little bit of you that thought maybe I should invest in one just for safety?
You know, he's a really good salesman. He's a really powerful, persuasive salesman, and he's successful for a reason. So, yeah. But ultimately, I think where I landed with it is that I would not want to be part of that community. I would not want to be part of a protected, sheltered elite or an elect that was being protected by a private army. On some level, I think I'd rather be dead. I'd rather be outside and take my chances. Because it seems, you know, from an ideological perspective, that is just too bleak and, too terrifying to me. The idea that would be, you know, where I land with in the book is if you're preparing for the collapse of civilization in that way, I think for you, civilization has already collapsed.
So let's talk about Mars and people who hope to use Mars as a backup planet when Earth is destroyed. Tell us about the thinking behind this.
Yeah, well, so Mars is like the, you know, if everything goes wrong here and the planet gets hit by an asteroid or whatever, Mars is kind of the term that is used amongst Mars enthusiasts would be, we need a backup planet. So we need a backup planet for humanity in case something goes catastrophically wrong with Earth. You know, Elon Musk is always using this term. Elon Musk would be, I suppose, the most prominent kind of advocate of Mars exploration, obviously with his space exploration company, SpaceX. But yeah, it's things like climate change, the prospect of, you know, an asteroid strike, anything that could present an existential threat. The idea is that, you know, even on the long-term kind of scale, the sun is going to burn out eventually. And the idea is that we need to sort of ensure the future of humanity. And so we need a kind of a second place to form a backup for civilization and for the species. And I found this just a fascinating kind of emanation of the apocalyptic kind of mood of our time.
So one of the things that kind of baffles me in a way about this Mars colonization premise is that, I mean, I don't know that much about space travel, but I would assume that if Mars was actually colonized and used as a backup planet, that would be far enough into the future that the people who are in this movement now would not be alive by the time it happens.
I think some of them certainly would hope that they will be around for it. I think, you know, Elon Musk, for instance, who is kind of the major advocate of Mars colonization at this point, I think. I think he's pretty explicit about the fact that he wants personally to get to Mars. So, you know, these are optimistic people. And, you know, a lot of them do believe that they will get to Mars, or at least humans will get to Mars in our lifetimes. But yeah, I mean, it is very much a long-term, sort of long-scale project. And it's about, you know, as I say, having a backup planet for civilization. So it's not, you know, as much as certain individuals might want to see Mars in their time, it's not really about the individuals. It's about the idea of, you know, preserving the species. If, you know, if an asteroid hits Earth or if the sun explodes or whatever, you want to have a backup planet for humanity. And that's, you know, where Mars is kind of comes into it.
One of the places you went to was Chernobyl. Why did you want to go there? People are not building bunkers in Chernobyl. No one wants to live on the site of a nuclear catastrophe.
Well, you know, I wanted to see what the end of the world looked like in a way. And I also wanted to see what a kind of a catastrophic event on the order of Chernobyl. What happens afterwards? And I was fascinated by the ways in which life is kind of returning to this place in ways. You know, nature is thriving there. And not only nature, but people are living there. There's a relatively small number of people, you know, in the dozens, but there are, and, you know, generally older people who have returned there to live in their houses that they evacuated in the immediate aftermath of the disaster. And so there are people living there. But ultimately, what I was really interested in was, you know, catastrophe tourism. There are tour companies that have set up in and around Kiev who will bring you there, and you can stay overnight, which is what I did on the tour. And, you know, you get to explore Pripyat, which is the abandoned city that was purpose-built for the workers in Chernobyl. And there's a just it's a fascinating kind of insight into the sort of visual spectacle of the apocalypse. You know, you get to wander around this kind of diorama of a sort of post-apocalyptic future, and I think that's what attracts the people who are on this tour, and, you know, to some extent myself.
So what does it look like?
It's pretty grim. You know, I went, it was a beautiful day, that, you know, the 2 days I was there. So, you know, nature has reclaimed the place. Pripyat is full of, like, you know, nature just bursting forth out of concrete. And there is something sort of quietly beautiful about it. And there's, you know, wolves, that has quite a large population of wolves there. So life is kind of going on without humanity. So there's something, as bleak as it is, there's something slightly reassuring about that. I wouldn't recommend it as a honeymoon destination or a sort of weekend getaway, but that's not what I was there for.
How much did the tour cost?
The tour was, I think it was something around maybe £250, which is a lot of money in Ukraine. I think it's close to like a monthly wage, so it's a huge amount of money. But they bring you on the tour from Kiev, so you get on the tour bus outside of McDonald's in Maidan Square, and it's about a 2-hour drive to the zone, and then, you know, it's heavily sort of controlled or patrolled by the army still at this point, so you need a passport to get in, and they check your passport, and you're sort of rigorously checked for radiation at various points along the way towards the power plant, and, you know, they bring you around this place and show you what it was like to live in this place and what it's like now. There are some, you know, threats of, you know, pockets of radiation that are quite high. But in general, the cleanup was very successful. And, you know, the guides know where they're taking you, so you don't stray into any particularly, you know, hotspot zones or whatever. The one thing they do tell you is don't eat the moss. I wasn't going to eat the moss anyway, but they're quite, quite sort of strict about eating anything from the ground, particularly moss. Moss soaks up a lot of radiation. So if you do go to Chernobyl, do not eat the moss.
So you weren't worried about exposure to radiation on the tour?
Well, you know, you've read my book, so you know I'm quite an anxious person. So I did find ways to be worried. You know, mostly after the fact. Like, I got back from the 2-day tour and I was like, what did I do? Why did I stay overnight in Chernobyl? Why was I, you know, what was it worth it? I'm still, you know, I'm okay. But I think the thing that you realize pretty quickly is that almost everywhere you go, the levels of radiation are actually lower than they would be. You know, they measure the radiation with a dosimeter outside McDonald's in the McDonald's in Kiev. And it's quite a bit higher than it is in most of the places where you are in the zone. So any kind of built up urban area would probably have higher radiation levels than any of the places where you actually go on the tour in the zone. Now, there are places where you just don't want to be within the zone. The power plant itself, certain spots there are still incredibly high, but you don't go anywhere near those.
How old are your children now?
My son just turned 7 a couple of weeks ago, just after the lockdown started, and our daughter is about to turn 2.
How has the virus affected your life as a father?
It's a really good question. I mean, we're still in the middle of it, so it's hard to have like real perspective on it. But in a way, like, our children's lives are very much in the home anyway, you know. Their sort of sense of the world is quite small. So certainly for our daughter, she has no idea anything is going on. It's just, you know, she's at home and her brother's at home, and that's great. My son misses his friends and he misses school. And that's starting to become a thing. He's not upset about it, but it's just, you know, we're aware of it. And when it started to happen first, when the lockdown happened first, I was basically okay with the day-to-day of my own experience. And, you know, I was getting through it. But the thing that made me most emotional, the thing that really sort of got to me, was the idea that my son would be, you know, possibly quite a bit older when he got to spend time with his friends again. And I would think about, you know, what if they're, you know, how much taller are they going to be? How much older are they going to be? Will they recognize each other? Will they feel strange around each other? And so thinking about those things made me quite emotional. And a sort of amazing thing happened on his birthday, actually. His little friend who lives across the street, she's a little bit older than him, but she dropped over a walkie-talkie in a bag with a birthday card for him. And like every day, more or less, since they've been talking to each other on walkie-talkies. And I think that's like, that just makes me feel okay. You know, I feel like they're finding ways to make contact with each other. They're finding ways to continue their relationships. You know, technology helps, you know. And kids are, you know, pretty resilient. And so I'm worried about the long-term future for sure. And I don't want this to go on too long. No one does. But I think they'll be okay.
Well, Mark O'Connell, it was great to talk with you. I wish you and your family well and good health and equanimity during this difficult period.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Mark O'Connell is the author of the book Notes from an Apocalypse. He spoke to us from Dublin.